The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome as well to our new audience in Memphis, Tennessee, joining the 480 other affiliates of the Hugh Hewitt Show. If you were listening last year when Pennsylvania was holding its Republican primary, I came in heavy for Dave McCormick, veteran of the 82nd Airport, West Point grad, former CEO of the huge company that I can't remember what your company was named, David. I'll look it up here in a second. Welcome back. Good to have you, Dave McCormick. Great to have you on the Hugh Hewitt Show, and congratulations on Superpower in Peril, your new book.
Hey, Hugh, thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
You know, I spent all day on airplanes yesterday reading Superpower in Peril and checking the wireless on SPV. And since you are you're a banker, you must know this stuff. How did you react to Silicon Valley Bank's demise and what the government did to save it? Because you're not only an investment banker, but you're also the former Undersecretary of Commerce, you know, Treasury, you know this stuff. What did you make of what the Fed did and the FDIC?
Well, I'm not a banker. I mean, it's like saying I was a lawyer, Hugh, but I do know a little bit about it. I talked to some folks yesterday. You know, I think the starting point for this, and it's important, is the what's happened with Silicon Valley Bank is a byproduct of a much broader set of things. 10 years of flawed fiscal policy and monetary policy, with it becoming dramatically more flawed in the last 2 years under Joe Biden. And the inflation rise at a time where you had zero interest rates forced the Fed to raise rates dramatically. And that's essentially put banks who were in a position to hold treasuries for long duration in this bind. That's point one. This is a byproduct, a direct line from Biden's policies. Second point is that Silicon Valley Bank handled this terribly, of all banks, the level of incompetence with which they handled it, the concentration of their depositors, is a disaster. And the regulators missed the boat. The San Francisco Fed missed the boat.
Third, oh, interesting. The San Francisco Fed specifically?
Yeah, because they're the oversight for the Silicon Valley Bank. And so if you look at their circumstances, this is not a complicated thing. They essentially have a huge deposit base of firms that are all in one industry, that are under a huge duress, and that all talk to one another. And they're all deposited at Silicon Valley Bank with 90% of the deposits uninsured. At the same time, Silicon Valley Bank has to capture yield, has put its balance sheet into long duration bonds. When the interest rates go up, those bonds are underwater. They have to sell assets. There's panic. And when the panic happens, people try to pull out their deposits. And that was a very obvious thing if you were a regulator who was kicking the tires and doing what they should do. So I think there's definitely some reflection to be done by our regulators just to see what the heck happened. Now, and then you talk about what to do.
Yes.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to add, what do we do about this? Because I think we just guaranteed every deposit in every bank in America. I just don't think you can do this for the blue bubble people in the Silicon Valley and tell Western Pennsylvania people pound sand when their banks get into trouble.
Yeah, listen, I'm worried about it. Listen, when you're in the middle of a crisis, you know, you don't want to throw beer cans from the stands. But here's the way I see it. I mean, I think it's completely appropriate. Management team gets wiped out of Silicon Valley Bank. The creditors are going to lose money. The equity holders are wiped out. But when you guarantee the depositors, I worry you've set a precedent. And so what's happening here is, you know, a lot of people get laid off, didn't get their bonuses. The guy who had, $500,000 for a window replacement is not going to get paid. And the people that had deposits, uninsured deposits, are going to get 100% payment. And so the reason they did that presumably is because they didn't want to suggest panic. And they did some other things, which I'll talk about in a minute. Didn't want to sort of plant seeds that, hey, the money in the bank is not good. And the reason that's so important is banking is all about confidence, because there's never enough money in the bank, right? If everybody goes to get their money, there's not enough money there. It's fractionally, it's a fraction of what's required. So you have to keep confidence in the bank. And so, good for the Fed and FDIC for trying to do that. But the problem is you set a precedent. That is it's a moral hazard, no doubt about it. These were sophisticated investors that were uninsured, moral hazard. And that moral hazard creates an expectation of the future. The second thing they did, which I'm more sympathetic to, and I'll come back to this, Hugh, if you want to ask more questions. The second thing they did, they created a liquidity for banks on all their deposits at 100% of par. So essentially what they did is that is a way, in my opinion, to give confidence that we're not going to have runs on the banks elsewhere. That's a little bit of a bailout too, to be honest with you. But that's that at least strikes me as a more systemic way to bring confidence. The Silicon Valley Bank is concerning for the moral hazard reasons.
Dave McCormick, as I read Superpower in Peril, I was very fascinated by the Bridgewater backstory on ESG, DEI, your tenure there, Ray Dalio, China. But I noted that you were making the round with Hank Paulson when 2008 collapse occurred. And I sat in the Oval with W and five other talk show hosts on the last Wednesday of his presidency. He was explaining to us the Sunday afternoons of 2008 were always spent doing something crazy that he swore he'd never do in his life. But they had to do it because 2008, we were at the brink of the collapse of the financial system. Are we back on that cliff this week, or we're not close to that cliff? What's Dave McCormick think?
You know, I've learned to not be too confident is the honest answer about these sorts of things. I think the response, particularly on the liquidity and that's available across the bank system, should go a long way in terms of giving some confidence. I think that we'll probably see some other banks that go through the washer here. But I think if I had to guess, we probably averted any near-term disaster. The bigger problem is where I started, which is you've got this low interest rate environment for a long, long time, and people making a bunch of investment decisions based on that. And now you have a rapid rise in inflation, which is leading to a rapid rise in interest rates, which is creating a mismatch. And that mismatch in our banking system, that mismatch across our economy, that's not gone away. And that's the direct result of the inflation that's been absolutely accelerated by the spending policies of Biden. And so until you get that fiscal house in order, until you get on more stable ground from a monetary perspective, I think we're in for a rough ride. And I think this is just one symptom. So I'd say we probably should, not worry about waking up like we did in 2008 with the market down by, 15% before the market's open, at least not now. But I think we're in for some rough days.
Dave McCormick, as I read Superpower in Peril, I had a lot of flashbacks to 2008. Because, and you emphasize, Bridgewater believes in transparency. Your book is very transparent about the issues that will drive Pennsylvania voters if you choose to run for Senate again. Here, I don't think the Biden administration is being particularly transparent. Yesterday, Joe Biden leaked, "We're not going to bail you out," to Axios in the morning. And by the afternoon, Janet Yellen is bailing out Silicon Valley Bank in the afternoon and Signal Bank. So the lack of transparency is always unsettling. Do you have a criticism or a comment on Team Biden's approach of communicating what their plan is and why they're acting this way?
I think the word bailout is politically such a toxic concept, and rightfully so. And I think what they're trying to do is put a wrapper on this that makes it seem like it's not that. But I think the fact remains that that this is not a small thing. It's an indication of a much bigger thing. And so when I hear President Biden talk about the efforts, for example, for working people, and I look at the policies that are leading to inflation, which first and foremost hits people, living on the edge from a working class Americans, but also people on a fixed income. So I don't think, as a general rule, the policies have been in line with the rhetoric. And the goals of the policies, however, give them the benefit of the doubt, certainly the actual outcomes of the policies are not leading to the kinds of pursuit of the American dream that I think we need to do, as I lay out in the book and in the way I describe, but also in the way that President Biden talks about. So I do think there's a mismatch. This is just another example of that.
Last question on this, Dave McCormick. One of my comments yesterday flying cross country was billions for the Blue Bubble Boys in Silicon Valley, and you don't get the time of day if you're in Eastern Ohio or Western Pennsylvania on the derailment. Some people thought that wasn't fair, but I believe it's, all of a sudden these connected VCs are on the phones to their buddies in D.C. They get action in 48 hours. We still haven't got the president in East Palestine, and you know that area very well. I mean, you grew up there. You probably are closer to East Palestine than I am. It was 40 miles down the road from Warren, but it's probably less from where you grew up.
Yeah. Well, from where I was born, certainly. Yeah, I grew up in a different part of the state, but I grew up around Scranton, but I was born right near there. And I've been talking to my friends at Beaver County who are most affected by it. And I agree with you 100% in the following sense. The thing that I discovered on the campaign trail, the thing that that I felt more viscerally, I should say, on the campaign trail, the thing that I think President Trump tapped into in 2016 is that there's this disconnect where the people that are making policy in Washington, in the Excella bubble between Washington and New York, are completely disconnected and really not particularly focused on or care about the people that are living in mainstream America. And that's certainly the case with, and the East Palestine thing is such a good example, not because the president showing up would have changed the outcome necessarily or even changed the policies. It would have been reflective of actually caring and being connected to the people that are most affected by it. And it's the same with fentanyl. It's the same with fracking. It's the same with inflation. It's the same with the open border. These are issues which are being felt by a huge part of America. And that was really the inspiration for the book, believing that that populist uprising that we're feeling has merit. It's based on the fact that the system isn't working for a huge chunk of Americans. And so what I tried to do in the book, and we can talk about that, is I try to bring together that populist impulse, which I think is reflective of a true gap in our system and policies, and traditional conservative principles that are tried and true and are key to the future of America. And I try to bring that together in an agenda about educating our people and confronting China and securing the country. And that's what I'm trying to do. And East Palestine is just an example of the things I heard on the campaign trail every single day.
Dave McCormick, I've got to teach you the Luntz rule, though. Frank Luntz has an iron rule that if you're selling a book, you've got to say the title of the book, Superpower in Peril, at least 7 times in every interview. And you haven't said Superpower in Peril once yet. So if people want to get Superpower.
I'm a rookie. Okay, listen, well, you've been saying it, so thank you for that. But it is the whole purpose of Superpower in Peril. Thank you.
Yeah, well, let's go to some of the most interesting stuff first, and then I'm going to walk through. I have 6 pages of notes, Dave. So unlike many of your interviewers, I've actually read Superpower in Peril, and it's very good. I learned a lot that I did not know. I didn't know that your wife, Dina, was a Copt from Egypt. I didn't know that she was an immigrant to the United States to become the Deputy National Security Advisor. And that story of her father meeting W coming off the plane, that's worth the book. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, I'll tell it. I'll tell it. Her dad was an Egyptian military officer under President Sadat, and he had 3 girls. He moved when Dina was 5 because he was worried that his children wouldn't really have a chance to grow up to be able to practice their religion and be free because of the sort of rise of an Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt. He moved to Texas, and he started by mowing lawns and driving a bus, and eventually became a very successful entrepreneur, but it was the American dream of practice. So when Dina wanted to figure out her path, she had to be a doctor, lawyer, and engineer. And sadly, she chose to go into politics, and she went and worked in Washington and worked for Dick Armey and eventually got to work in the White House. She was in the presidential personnel, and President Bush knew her because she helped build out the cabinet, but she went on to become much more senior person, but she was a junior person, really. And Bush came off the helicopter, Marine One, right next to the White House, and Dina had arranged for her father and a stepmother to have tickets where they could be on the rope. And President Bush came out of the helicopter, and he saw Mr. Habib and his wife on the rope and Dina next to him. So he walked right over to him and said, "Well, you must be Mr. Habib." And he was stunned. Dina's father was absolutely stunned. And he said, but the President Bush said, this is just indicative of his class. Your daughter is a very important advisor to me. Very important. Shook his hand, walked away. Tears streaming down his face. He could not believe that he could bring his daughter from Egypt and that his daughter would become an advisor to the President of the United States. Just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, at the end of every book, there's some things that stick. And I'm not going to forget. I've never met Dina. I've never met you in person, but I'm never going to forget that. By the way, I love W. It's not popular with some of my audience to say that, but he had the best heart of anyone who's been in the White House in my lifetime. Just his father had a great heart, too. But W. had a real heart for the people who worked for him and the people that he served. And he was all about protecting America. I'm glad you served there. I have one regret having read the brand new book that Dave McCormick has out there, Superpower in Peril. Is that President Trump offered you the deputy secretaryship of the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is the black hole of the Trump administration. Nothing got done. The 355 ship Navy didn't get built. The Columbia class did not stay on schedule. The shipyards did not get rebuilt. Do you regret declining President Trump's offer you to be number two at DOD? Because you would have then been number one at DOD when Jim Mattis left. You could have turned this around. Do you regret that decision?
You know, I don't, because I was at that point, I was really deep at Bridgewater. We were in the middle of really taking the company in a new direction, helping Ray, the founder, transition. And I felt obligated to try to bring that chapter to a close for him and for Bridgewater and the people that we were working with. And so I had always hoped that I might find a way to serve again. And so when I passed on that, I had a little bit of a heart tug because I thought that might be my last opportunity to serve. And so when the Senate seat came open and I saw an opportunity to serve and some of the good work at Bridgewater had been done, that was what motivated me to jump into the Senate race, as I describe in the book, Hugh, Superpower in Peril. The thing that was grabbing me at the time is the same thing that grabs me now, which is that 80% of Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. And I certainly feel that way. And the catalyst for jumping into the race was Afghanistan, which was such a humiliation and a debacle. And as an American, you know, trying to explain to my kids what was going on when the airplanes were taken off and, you know, people are dropping off out of the wheel wells and we're leaving our military equipment to the Chinese in Bagram Airport. It just, to me, was the last straw. And that was ultimately what got me in the race.
Well, I'm glad to see you in the field. I have a very practical question. I pray for John Fetterman. I want the guy to get better. I didn't want him to win, but I don't want him to be sick. He's hospitalized. I don't know how long he can do this for. If he retires and Josh Shapiro, who's a friend of mine and the new governor of Pennsylvania, he's probably a friend of yours, Josh Shapiro appoints someone, will you run against the appointee or will you run against Bob Casey?
You know, I'm with you on Senator Fetterman. Like, you put your heart goes out to him and his family. And, you know, I thought that Senator Fetterman and Senator Casey, for that matter, were both not right for Pennsylvania, because I think the progressive left has pulled the party to the left. And I think the policies that are in place are really contributing to the decline of America, as I describe in the book. And so, you know, I was motivated to run because Pennsylvania has not had a Republican senator for 76 years. This is the first time in 76 years we've had two Democrats in the Senate. And so I'm not sure. There's a short answer as things play out. A, whether I'm going to run. I haven't made that decision yet. And if I'm going to run, I would want to run believing that I could make a big difference. And, you know, the book is about the future of the country. And, you know, the question in my mind is, you know, do Republicans want to win? Because if Republicans want to win, in my opinion, they have to pick candidates that can win primaries and general elections. And I try to lay out in the book here that, you know, I think even if you look all across Republicans, we agree on 80% conservatives, 80% of the agenda. And I try to lay out that agenda in the book. 20% we disagree on. But sadly, that 20% we disagree on has made us unable at this point to put forward candidates who can win primaries and generals. The second thing we need, though, is an agenda looking forward. I don't believe we can win looking backwards. I don't think we can win based on a strategy of grievance. I think we have to look forward based on how we're going to fix the problems like inflation and fentanyl and China's rise and how we confront China and build back our defense and enable our children with great education. So that's what I think we need. And you know, my question to myself is, how can I best contribute to our future in along those lines?
Dave McCormick, you came in a few hundred votes behind Dr. Oz. If you had written Superpower in Peril 2 years ago, I believe you would have won that election, because there's a lot about Dave McCormick in this book that people just don't know. Is that, and you're also getting ahead of the ESG DEI issue and Bridgewater and Ray Dalio in this book. We're going to come back to that. Was that part of the motivation in that you just want to give potential voters in Pennsylvania a longer version of what they need to know rather than a stump speech?
Well, I started writing the book long before I decided to run for Senate, and I had sold the book. It was based on a couple articles I had written that had gotten some good feedback. And so it was about 60, 70% complete before I even entered the campaign. And then what happened was I put it on hold and went through the campaign. And of course, there's just thousands of stories that reinforce what you're seeing or make you emphasize things. So the book took a slightly different shape because it became more personal. And those stories became more pressing in terms of telling the story. But that's how it came about. And I do like the fact that when you're on the campaign trail, you know, the two things that were hard for me, and it's even hard in this interview, which you're probably feeling, is that it's hard to talk about complex things in 30 seconds. And so when you write a book, you get to actually lay things out and make the case. The second thing was hard for me on the campaign trail is you got to talk about yourself and say, hey, this is how great I am. This is why I can be, you know, great for Pennsylvania. And that wasn't a natural thing for me. And so in the book, Superpower and Peril, I try to tell my story, but only as it relates to the particular recommendations and the policies. And I try to tell it in a way that's, you know, human. So I talk about all the things I've screwed up, and, you know, I talk about getting fired, and I talk about a bunch of other things. And you don't get to do that on the campaign trail either. So I'm honestly not sure if this, I hope you're right. I'm honestly not sure if this book is good politically or not politically, but I'm really sure that it's authentically me, and I feel great about that.
Oh, I think you can say asked and answered to a lot of questions now. And at every stop, if you run, you're going to have copies of Superpower in Peril with you. And you can say, if you want to learn more about the Chinese Communist Party and the threats that it poses across the board, it's detailed over here in Superpower in Peril. I learned, however, if you're a paratrooper and you're the first person out of the plane, one, don't invite your parents to watch, and two, make sure the next guy doesn't jump on top of you. We almost added another memorial at Gettysburg that day. Tell that story.
Exactly. Yeah, that was something. So my parents, we had a battalion in the 82nd, and the colonel would take us to battlefields, and we walked the battlefield, you know, 25 officers in the battalion to learn the lessons of leadership and warfighting. So we would go to different battlefields across the country. And of course, because we were paratroopers, we'd get an airplane and we'd arrange to parachute into that area, wherever it was. We'd spend a day or two there, and then we'd parachute back. We'd fly back to Fort Bragg and parachute back. So it came that we were going to do Gettysburg, which I had done a couple times at West Point, and walking the battlefield of Gettysburg is incredible. And so my folks live in Harrisburg. So I called him up and said, I'm coming. We're going to do this. We have arranged this farmer's field. And so I had them to be there on time to watch us jump in. But it's hard to tell who's who. So I arranged to be the first person out of the airplane so my parents would know. And sure enough, we went over the farmer's field. The jump master, who's the person that gives you the okay, I jumped out of the airplane. And I saw this beautiful farmer's field behind me. And then I heard a little sound. I looked up, and there was feet running across my canopy. The guy that came out after me was on top of me, and my parachute collapsed. And so for a minute, or not a minute, but a few seconds, you know, my parachute was had folded. I was starting to fall. And then he ran off the side, and my parachute redeployed. And I landed safely, and I rolled up my parachute and ran over to my mom and dad. And they were in absolute tears. And never came to anything again.
No, and yeah, Dave McCormick, I have got a son, a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty, and I don't want to know what they're doing until it's over. Like, my son was at Al-Assad when the Iranians decided to, you know, blanket it with ICBMs, got out 10 minutes beforehand on a helicopter. I said, don't tell me about this stuff. I'm very proud of your service, but I don't want to know where you are, and I don't want to watch you jump out of an airplane when God, I mean, did they know what was happening? Did they see it?
Oh, Oh, they saw the whole thing. No, it was tough on Paris. They saw the whole thing. But the reason I tell the story in the book is, so Adams County is right there at Gettysburg. And I was at an event at Adams County. And it was a number of people who were pretty hostile.
Very pro-Trump. Trump had come out against you, and the former president had labeled you as a globalist, et cetera.
Right. Trump had come out against me, and it attacked me and so forth. So this group was somewhat hostile to me. And so we're sitting there at breakfast, and I'm eventually going to get to talk. So I stand up and talk, and I tell that story because I'm right there in Gettysburg. We drove through Gettysburg to get to the breakfast, and it warmed up the whole group. And, you know, it just reinforces a point. We have so much in common. And the thing that we care about, which is the future of America and patriotism and commitment to our men and women in uniform, that there's a lot of common bonds. And as much as we fight among ourselves and fight across our country as Americans, man, we got to continue to come back to what we agree on. And that was one of the things we agree on, is that we love our men and women in service.
Dave McCormick, when I was reading Superpower in Peril and Ray Dalio's name came up. Now, I would not know Ray Dalio if I walked into him on a bus. I wouldn't know him from Adam. I know his name only because of the ESG stuff. He's the venture capitalist everybody loves to hate. He's Mr. DEI. You explain what the ESG approach was. I always say it stands for evading the scrutiny of government if you're a big enough person in the United States. But explain to people what the Bridgewater approach to ESG and DEI, they're separate issues, but you are very candid in Superpower in Peril about the threat they pose to shareholder value. And I think we have a sponsor, it's consumersresearch.org. That's all they do is track ESG-driven companies. And they don't do as well as non-driven ESG companies, at least as ESG has come to be understood, which is to be blinkered vis-a-vis China, but to be down on everybody in America in the carbon fuels business.
Yeah. Well, just to be fair to Ray, that, I don't think Ray's known for that at all. Ray created Bridgewater. Bridgewater is a global macro investor. And so it's one of the largest in the world. Ray created this really unique culture. Wildly successful. So ESG was never really his thing. He's been very strong voice on China, which he's gotten a lot of criticism for. And he and I had some disagreements on, which I try to talk about in the book, particularly how we should think about China as a threat and how America should deal with China. But to your point around ESG and D&I, there's two stories I really tell in the book. One is that my entire life, I've been so proud of the fact that I have built high-performing teams. And when I've tried to build high performance, whether I was an Army officer or whether I was a CEO of a tech company in Pittsburgh or whether I was a CEO of Bridgewater, and those high performing teams were highly diverse, great women, great men from all sorts of backgrounds. I mean, the military has people from all over the place, and you come together in a common mission. And I was always proud of the fact that I did a great job of building those teams that were highly diverse and was recognized for it, and that I stuck so clearly to merit. And merit driving decisions in hiring, firing. A high performing team is only as effective as its weakest link. And so you have to embrace reality. And Ray was really strong in embracing reality, and you have to build great teams. And I talked about the pressure and the drumbeat to make compromises along those lines because of the pressures from, everything from clients to internal employees to the broader agenda that CEOs have adopted. The ESG point, I'll hit that quickly. I agree with you 100%. What's happened is you've had investment managers, BlackRock's a good example, but there are a number of others, that have embraced ESG and tried to dictate that companies should incorporate ESG as part of the criteria on whether they'll invest in those companies. And you're seeing now the huge backlash, which I agree with, of a number of states, in particular pension plans, to say, no way. We want to invest in a way that protects us as fiduciaries. And what that means is we need to invest in a way that's not driving a social agenda, but driving an agenda for the best return for our pensioners. And that's something I agree to with 100% and I talk about in the book.
I would have no objection to ESG if it was actually genuine. If they looked at the Uyghurs in the concentration camps, if they looked at Hong Kong losing their freedom, if they looked at any of the issues that you touch on about the Chinese Communist Party and incorporated that, ESG would actually work to decouple us from China. But that's not happening. What do you think of a country that cannot put an NBA player on TV and ask them about China because they go, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil? We are in the pockets of the Chinese Communist Party in many sectors of America.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I try to hit that in the book, Superpower and Peril. And it talks about confronting China is one of our key priorities. And, you know, when you're a CEO, one of the things you learn, Hugh, is that there's lots of things that need to be fixed and that are broken. But zeroing in on the three or four things that are most important to America's exceptionalism, America's renewal was the thing I tried to do in the book. And then confronting China, you know, we need a whole of nation strategy. Right now, there's this action or that action. There's not sort of a we're all in this together with a holistic view of how to take on China. And I lay out in the book five things that I think we should do. The first is we need to decouple our economies strategically. So microchips, pharmaceuticals, there's a whole range of industries that I'm embarrassed to admit, I didn't even know how dependent we were on the Chinese for pharmaceuticals until COVID happened. The fact that 90% of our microchips are manufactured 90 miles from mainland China is lunacy. But this is the situation we've let ourselves get in. So we have to right that immediately. Second thing we need to do, to your point. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you mentioned, let's stay on chips for a second. I was unaware that between 1990 and 2020, China built 37 fabs and we built none. Now we've got one underway in Ohio. Thank God, Ohio, not Pennsylvania. And we've got one underway in Texas, but that's not enough. Did you like the CHIPS Act or did you not like the CHIPS Act?
I liked the goal of the CHIPS Act. I didn't like the substance of the CHIPS Act in the following sense. It was inadequate investment in R&D. And then, you know, here we just see that they put on top of these subsidies, which are direct subsidies to companies. I lay out in the book how I would think about bringing key sectors of technology to the forefront. It's not the way they're doing it here. But the subsidies are connected to all sorts of progressive policies that have to go along with them. The Commerce Department just rolled out a whole agenda on you have to have childcare, you have to have this and that. So taking something that's of criticality to our national security, and then it's just what's happening in the military too, where the climate agenda is almost usurped the warfighting agenda. That's what's happened to the CHIPS Act. So the idea that we need to invest differently and make a huge investment in microchips, I'm 100% in agreement with. The way it was designed, I have some issues with.
Can I talk a moment about Coach Lynn? Do you mind talking about your football coach? Because everyone in the audience either has had a coach, is a coach, or knows a coach, and they know how coaches talk. And there's a lot. You're a football player. You went to West Point as a wrestler. You became captain of the wrestling team and all that good stuff. And we'll talk about that. But when you're a football player, you're kind of the leader, and Coach Lynn comes in at halftime. He is not happy with David McCormick. And I wish I had a tape of this. What do you think Coach Lynn, is he still with us, by the way? Is he still alive?
He died. He died about, I don't know, 20 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think Coach Lynn would think about the way politics are being done in our leadership elites today?
He'd be kicking ass and taking names. He was a great guy. I'll tell the story quickly if it's okay with you, but I was a sophomore in high school and I was a bench warmer. You know, I'd only get pulled into games when we were winning big or losing big. But when I got in, I'd really kill myself and I played defense and I had a few big tackles. And the coach got fired. We got a new coach. So he watched films all summer and he calls me out of the blue and says, Coach Lynn, I'm the new coach. Come on in and see me. And he said, listen, I watched the films. You got real potential. I want you to be our starting linebacker, but you got to earn it. So go to camp and work your tail off. And so I did it. I worked so hard that summer. And at the end of the summer camp, he pulled me aside and said he wanted me to be the co-captain of the team as a junior. And this was inconceivable to me. Inconceivable. I would have never dreamed it in a million years. And it made me start to see myself differently than I had ever seen myself before. And so our team turned out to be pretty good. And the second year won a big championship. But boy, the standards that he put on me. And that thing I tell in the story is about a game where we were playing. It was a drought. It was a rain, a huge rainstorm. And we were playing terribly in the first half. And he came in and I had a lot of press that week leading into it saying, you know, I was doing a good job. And he came in and went after the whole team. And then he kept saying at the end of it, he'd say, and Dave McCormick, you've done such a good job. You're really, those press clips we're reading about, you're really great. You know, complete sarcasm. And then at the end of it, at the end of that time, he just laid into me. I mean, I just, It was so punishing. I just, you know, but I was the leader. And so I couldn't shirk. I didn't want to stand there and take it. And so we went out the second half and we turned things around. And what I learned from him is accountability, man. If you're a leader, you got to step up and take responsibility. You got to demonstrate. You got to lead by example. And you have to hold yourself to the highest of standards.
It's one of the best anecdotes in Superpower in Peril, because it really does say, if you're going to be a leader, if you aspire to that, you've got to be accountable. And if you get the bark taken off of you, that's part of the job. And I just thought, you know, there's a lot of great stories in Superpower in Peril. We're going to get to some substance here. But coach stories resonate with Americans. Have you told that story up and down Pennsylvania, by the way?
I've told it a few times, probably need to tell more. You know, the happy end of the story is not, he's passed. But when I was in the Gulf War, I had the presence of mind to write a letter to us, you know, almost 10 years later, and tell him just how much he meant to me. And, you know, we did stay in close touch, but just tell me he made the difference. You know, I became an All-State linebacker. I went to West Point. All of this was because of something he saw. And he died. And I talked to his son 4 or 5 years ago, who's now a fishing guide in Wyoming. And I go fishing every year now in Wyoming, and we'll fish for a couple of days and we'll talk about his dad. And he said that letter was his dad's prized possession. So, you know, these little things, whenever somebody comes up to me and says, hey, can I have 20 minutes to talk about my future? And you have a million things going on, you say, you think to yourself, I can't do it. I always think, man, I got to do it, because, you know, maybe I could be Coach Lynn to somebody if I can shoot straight with it.
It's a great prism through which another thing that comes through in Superpower in Peril. I'm a big advocate. I'm a civilian. I have got no military experience, and so I try not to opine on this. But the reason I read Tom Cotton's book, Only the Strong, or Mike Pompeo's book, Never Give an Inch, or anyone like you and they who've served at a platoon level leadership, is that, as you explain, you've got a bunch of people from all over America are privates. You got this Puerto Rican sergeant who's keeping the green lieutenant from blowing up his whole airborne C company. And if you've led in the military, you've led all of America. It really is the last melting pot. And I think, even without intending to do it, you communicated that message again. We need more veterans, whether it's of the first Gulf War, the second Afghanistan, the war on terror, Somalia, wherever we go, we need more veterans in Congress.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, I was telling this story the other day. You know, I had this platoon. It was very, white kid from rural Alabama, black kid from North, Puerto Rican platoon sergeant who, you know, kicked the new lieutenant's butt. And all that time of deploying, going around the world, training around the clock, I don't ever remember talking about politics. In fact, I can't even remember I don't even know if I knew what party they were or what their views were. We were just in it together. We were in it as a team. Try to, you know, serve the country, serve one another. And that bonding experience, I think, puts your responsibility in context. You know, Walter Buckley had this great line that citizenship is a combination of the privilege of being part of the greatest country in the world and the responsibility to keep it that way. And so the military is one way to exercise that responsibility. And you know, factually, 1950, 80% of the members of Congress were veterans, of course, after World War II. Today, it's about 19%. And I think that matters. It doesn't have to be the military, but a common bond that brings us together. Honestly, it's one of the reasons I'm so concerned about, and I talk about in the book, Superpower and Peril, the disaster of American history in our schools. Because if you're not taught America's an exceptional a nation, and you don't believe that, then when it starts to not be exceptional, you don't feel the motivation to fix it and preserve it. And the military helps you do that.
Yeah, I've gotten to know Michael Waltz a little bit. My son works for him, but I got to know him because he's part of the Nixon seminar. And he's now chairman of the Readiness Subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee in the House. And we are not ready. I mean, you go at length in Superpower in Peril. The Chinese Communist Party has built the largest navy in the world in 10 years. They have this massive mound of missiles. You talk about in the Gulf War, you had to blow up one base full of Iraqi weaponry. And by the way, I don't know how you do that. You didn't go into the detail. How do you blow up 18 miles or square miles of 18 acres of munitions and not get blown up? How do you do that?
You know, we had to go down underneath and rig each bunker. And then each bunker needed to be rigged onto a chain that went throughout the facility. So when you blew it up, you blew them all up at the same time. So they were, there was a, there was a, uh, a linkage across each one of the bunkers. So it was quite a an undertaking.
So we're just not. We need people who have done things like that in Congress. Now I want to go to China and make sure that we, in our time left, David, we talk about that because you spend a lot of time on the Chinese Communist Party. Earlier today, I had on Len Khodorkovsky, who was Keith Kroc's deputy. I told him you gave Keith a lot of shout outs in Superpower in Peril, which I don't know if he knows or not, but you were very much into the clean network approach. Over the weekend or over the last week, I was on vacation. China inked a deal with Saudi Arabia and Iran in Beijing. This sent a shudder. I know we have a banking crisis. We've got a Stanford Law School meltdown over DEI. But people should be paying attention to the fact that China just flipped the Nixon script. They brought Saudi Arabia to Beijing to become frenemies with Iran. That is geopolitics at the highest level. And once again, Biden got hold my beer, Joe Biden. He wasn't even aware of it.
Right. And you know why I think that happened is because if you're a traditional ally of the United States, if you want to be pro-American and you want to put your chips on America under this president or Joe Biden, I think you've got real worries. And I believe that's what's happened in this case with many of our friends. Saudi Arabia has been a longstanding ally. That's not to defend some of the bad behavior, but a longstanding ally. I was stationed in Saudi Arabia for almost a year in preparation for the invasion into Iraq. They're a critical ally in the world. And I know from a fact in my conversations across the world that if you've been depending on America and you watch what happened in Afghanistan, or you watch the ham-handed movement early on with Nord Stream 2 and the invitation of Putin into Ukraine, and you look at the way we're handling China, you're worried that you don't have a steady hand in the White House who's going to project strength and preserve that alliance and defend it. And that's what's happened with Saudi Arabia, I believe. And so it's also a byproduct of a second thing, which is China. China has a strategy. China has a plan for global primacy. It's a techno-authoritarian plan to project an ideology around the world, and they're executing the plan. And as I say in the book Superpower in Peril, they have a plan. What's our plan? And sadly, we don't have a plan. We don't have a plan to build muscle at home and engage abroad in a way that ensures America's superpower. And that's the whole purpose of the book, lay that agenda out.
You're very complimentary of Robert Lighthizer as our trade rep for bringing trade. It actually brought China to the table. It began the pivot. You quote Mike Pompeo at the Nixon Library. I interviewed the secretary when he was our guest at the Nixon Library after his remarks. It was an important moment in American global history. We pivoted away from China. We broke the Nixon deal, and we did it because they broke it earlier. Here's the key question. You talk a lot about data, and I'm glad you did. Nobody talks about the importance of data. They've got 1.2 billion people. We have 330 million people. So they're capturing the billion people's data every day. We have no systemic approach to data. What is the recommendation there? I know you're concerned about privacy. I've written extensively about the book, The Rise of Surveillance Capitalism. It's a double-edged sword. Data drives AI. AI drives the future. Privacy drives Americans personally. How do we walk that line, Dave McCormick? You lay it out in the book, but I want you to summarize it for the audience.
Yeah. Well, it's a very challenging line to walk, as you said. I think the starting point is data is incredibly valuable. It's strategic in a way that I don't think we have embraced as a country. And China has a real advantage because it not only has data, but it has complete control of the data. And that's a driver of innovation in artificial intelligence and a number of things. And it's one of the reasons. There was a report, Hugh, I'm not sure if you saw it, but the Australian think tank came out a couple weeks ago. It was written in the Wall Street Journal that of 44 critical technologies, satellites, AI, 5G, and so forth, China was in the lead in 37 of them. This is an independent Australian think tank. And data is a big reason for that because they've got that data advantage. And so we need to treat data. People talk about data as the new oil. It's more than oil because it can be used over and over again. And if you look at the success of the COVID vaccines, they were partly driven by the ability to pull data together. So data is important. That's point number one. We have no strategy for dealing with data. And so we need a strategy for drawing on data from our allies, like the 5G countries that we share intelligence with. We need a process for protecting our data, too. From the Chinese, because TikTok and others are getting access to our data every day, but we also need a process for protecting our data from our own social media companies. Doesn't it give you a little bit of an eerie feeling when you buy a pair of sneakers online and then the next 10 times you get any inbound things that it's other vendors that have bought your data and are trying to send you sneakers? Imagine what the world has access to about you. I mean, I read an article recently where the Chinese knew what our troops were doing in Afghanistan because they were reading their Fitbit data.
That's in the book. That's remarkable. I had no idea. And as you say, all of our data goes to Beijing, but none of Beijing's data comes out. It's a completely imbalance. But decoupling. I want to close here. I want to close by talking about the elites that you discuss and the administrative state. I'm writing a piece for the Post that'll run sometime this week about the administrative state and how it is destroying fishing in the Atlantic and water conservation on the Pacific. Everywhere they go, they destroy stuff. Meanwhile, the FDIC in San Francisco or the Federal Reserve in San Francisco is not doing their job. I ran OPM for 2.5 years. You were doing exciting and interesting things. I was running OPM. Nobody cares about OPM. But we got 2.85 million civilian employees. How do we get control of this government, Dave McCormick? The administrative state is just enormous and is impacting everyone. And then when a crisis happens, as in East Palestine, close to where you grew up, nothing happens. It's completely dysfunctional.
Yeah. Well, it's, I talk a lot in the book, as you say, in Superpower and Peril, about institutional decay.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is happening in our institutions. And it's sadly our institutions of government. It's also our schools. It's also our military to some degree. It's our business community. It's our churches. This is a systemic societal problem. And when I was in the government before, I remember coming into the Treasury and, thinking from a leadership and management perspective, it was lacking in some ways, to say the least. And the guidance and the feedback I got from everybody was, we don't have time for that. We do not have time for that. What we have to get is right, is the policies right. And I think that's been perpetually what's happened. And as a consequence, we've got this embedded bureaucracy that's ideologically opposed to what we as conservatives believe. And it makes the capacity to fix things very challenging. And so we've got to root it out. And we've got to have leadership in place. We've got to win elections, first and foremost. The starting point is winning the House, the Senate, and the White House. And then we've got to have that be a critical agenda. And there's lots of things that President Trump did that I agree with. One of them was the simple idea of for every new regulation, you take away two. I mean, it seems so simple, but it's a very clarifying approach. There's a ridiculous, I saw this in the fracking industry, the amount of regulatory overreach is beyond compare. I see it in the Army. We talked about defense. If I was Secretary of Defense, I would root out the idea that the United States Army is going to release its climate strategy before its warfighting strategy. This is the kind of madness that takes over when you have a bunch of people embedded in the bureaucracy that have an agenda that's inconsistent with conservative agenda, but in my mind, but more than that, inconsistent with what I think is best for America. And so it takes leadership, and it's going to be like in Pennsylvania football, 1 to 2 yards at a time in a cloud of dust. That's the only way to do it.
That's an Ohio thing. You can't steal from Ohio everything, Dave. I'm telling you right now. Let me close by asking you about, obviously, you're considering a Senate run. You could run for president and just skip this. You got the book out. You could just run for president. You'd be up against your buddy Pompeo, another West Point grad and about your age, et cetera. But there's plenty of room on the stage. Is that in the back of your mind at all?
No. I mean, my wife just insists that I get some job of some sort. So she'd be open to just about any job. but no. I mean, what I hope if this book was wildly successful beyond my dreams, we would have people that are running for president and ultimately who win the presidency use this as at least an input to the direction to take the country. I don't see this. I don't see people looking forward enough. I'm not directing that to any specific person. I think we need to have leadership that looks forward. And as I just said in the book, and I said the other day, when I interviewed your friend, it was interviewed by your friend Selena Zito. I'm not sure if this book is a winner politically. I'm not sure if a happy warrior wins in American politics today. But that's what I am, And that's what I want to be. And we'll see if there's a place for that. I hope there is, but I'm not sure.
Last comment, Dave McCormick. You write a lot about Reagan. I was there. I worked for him for 6 years. I was with Nixon in San Clemente when Jimmy Carter was destroying Iran and when Carterism gripped the United States. And we got lucky. We got a Reagan. I've got a friend who tells me we need another Reagan, a member of the Senate that you may be joining. You know, you don't get another Reagan all the time. Do you think we can turn this around, or is the Thucydides trap upon us and we just have to get used to it?
Well, you know, the irony is if you look at the cover of my book, Superpower in Peril, it's red and blue and it's ominous. And it's like, wow, it looks like it's a and then the book's optimistic. And so I am optimistic. And the reason I'm optimistic is, in fact, what you lived through, and I lived through more as a kid, but I lived through the dog days of the Carter administration and the waiting line for gas with odd days and even days and stagflation and Desert One. And, you know, my dad had a big country school. We'd sit in line for 45 minutes to fill up the tank. And then that was in 1979. 4 years later, I was at West Point walking along those beautiful pathways, and it was morning in America. 4 years from 80% of Americans thinking the country was going in the wrong direction, sound familiar, to a morning in America. So I think it's always easy to underestimate the power of leadership and vision. But I think we get the right leadership and the right vision and look forward, not backward. We're going to, you know, it's the American tradition. We get to the edge of the cliff and we pull ourselves back. And I think we'll do that again.
I think Superpower in Peril is a first step towards turning a lot of happy warriors into happy warriors again and getting them out of the resignation and off of the chair and out of the couch. Dave McCormick, thanks for spending a lot of time with me. Congratulations on Superpower in Peril, going to be a bestseller. Keep coming back, and I hope you run. I really do hope you run in the Keystone State. They need somebody to help them out, even though that line about Pittsburgh in here almost stopped me pretty early on. You say something about Pittsburgh, almost stopped me right there. But there it is. Pittsburgh holds a special place in my heart, page 73. Almost put the book down because you've got to be a Steelers fan, right?
Oh, yeah. But you forgive me once, you'll forgive me again.
Yeah, your quarterback had little hands. We'll see what happens. Dave McCormick, thank you. Congratulations. Keep coming back.
Sure. Good day. Thank you.
Friends, 2022 is history, but have you thought about what you will do in 2023? What will you do to make yourself better than last year? I have a challenge for you. Resolve to become a better educated citizen. Look, every year is a new opportunity, so I have a great way for you to make the most of this one. Our good friends at Hillsdale College have made their online courses free. They're all amazing, and they're free to all who wish to learn. My challenge to you, take just one. You can discover the beauty of the Bible in the Genesis story, study the writings of C.S. Lewis, or explore the true meaning of America in Constitution 101. There are many more to choose from, and these are all self-paced, free courses featuring Hillsdale faculty and scholars. So visit hughforhillsdale.com, that's hughforhillsdale.com, and just pick one of the more than 30 free Hillsdale courses. I hope you accept my challenge. Pick whichever course you'd like, and resolve to be a more educated American in 2023. Go to hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today. Sunny California, joined as I am most Monday mornings by Jake Sherman, editor-in-chief of Punch Bowl News. And Jake, what a slow news weekend for you. Nothing going on at all. So I
didn't have much of a weekend.
nor did anyone lobbying for Blue Bank and Blue Bubble, Silicon Valley investment capital and investment bankers. Look, Janet Yellen began the morning saying, no bailout yesterday, and they closed last night by bailing out the Silicon Valley Bank, and there is no other word for it. It's a bailout. Now, it might be necessary. I was being persuaded in real time that regional banks faced runs on this, but the Treasury people are talking like, don't worry, no federal money involved, not a bailout. It's a bailout, Jake. I mean, it's just a bailout.
It's not a bailout of the bank. If it's a bailout of anything, it's a bailout of depositors, because the bank has been put into conservatorship and is not going to exist, at least in its current form. But depositors above the $250,000 FDIC-insured limit are going to get their money out. And we asked this morning, we have a really talented financial services reporter, Brendan Peterson, who makes the argument that what good are these rules where if a bank screws up, there's basically no consequence, and they get and people get their money out. So yeah. I think that's a very good question to ask right now. And I will say this, you will not be looking. You know, the House is controlled by Republicans who have argued for less stringent capital requirements of banks. That's not a criticism. That's a fact. So I would not be expecting any sort of legislation here around Silicon Valley Bank.
No, but I do expect that Vivek Ramaswamy's response will become the standard response, which is billions for blue bubble bankers and not the time of day for East Palestine and Western Pennsylvania, because the two things are juxtaposed. They worked all weekend long to come up with there is no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation limit anymore, in my view. If they've done this for SVB, would they dare not do it for any other regional bank, Jake? Because the idea that you're only insured to $250,000 is not true if you've got lobbyists and a lot of VC people who've... I mean, this bank had its own ski chalet. So Roku, which had $500 million with the bank, of which $250,000 was insured... Roku, I don't know who they contribute to, but I'll bet you they were on the phone all weekend.
Well, interestingly enough, as we noted on, I think, in our Friday edition, Silicon Valley Bank didn't actually have a big lobbying operation. They only had one lobbyist for the last several years. They are not a big player in Washington. But I think what the administration tried to do here, according to their own telling of it, is they did not want a run on regional banks. If you look, I haven't looked in the last 30 minutes, but First Republic Bank, which is another San Francisco-based bank that caters to high-net-worth individuals and a lot of Wall Street folks, their stock is down 60% this morning, or 50%. I can't remember what it was when I last turned off the TV. So, you know, these regional banks, which have been a part of our economy for a very long time, face unexpected pressure. And I think a lot of people are saying, I mean, people I spoke to over the weekend in business and in finance are saying, well, listen, why would I go to these regional banks if I can have my money in Citibank or Truist or JP Morgan Chase, where basically they're too big to fail. The government, you know, really has a close eye on them. And I think that's where a lot of people are heading right now.
Well, too big to fail now is a second category. Too big to fail because they're big, and too big to fail because they're blue. And this is a blue bank. I mean, Jake, this is a bank with a ski chalet. And obviously,
yeah,
they're all.
Though, not, I don't think that makes a damn bit of a difference.
People it absolutely does. You know why? I got touched yesterday. I'm sure I'm just like every member of the banking committee. I got touched by VCs I've never heard of, never talked to. And I got touched by small businessmen who were urging me to stop the regional bank. So I heard it all yesterday. But the blue bubble people in the Silicon Valley, they worked the phones all weekend long to make this happen, Jake.
Yeah, Peter Thiel, who's a no lefty, had a lot of money in there and pulled a lot of his money out.
Oh, he got his money out. Peter got his money out. Peter's no dummy.
And by the way, it was very interesting to see all these, a lot of right-leaning Silicon Valley people, venture finance people, people like that, who have argued, leave us alone, no regulation, less regulation, we need to be free, all of a sudden in favor of the government bailing out Silicon Valley Bank. So, I mean, it was head-snapping, to say the least.
Well, I did as much as I could on two cross-country flights to look into the SVB board of directors. We've got senior former Obama Treasury officials on the bank.
Yep.
We've
yep.
got lots of people who make lots of contributions to Democrats. Those, by the way, those directors are wiped out. Their options are worthless. The people who had a lot of money invested in SBF, they're not getting bailed out. It's just depositors. But if this had been a regional bank near East Palestine, Ohio, do you think it would have happened, Jake? Because they don't even have the time of day for East Palestine, but they've got billions for Silicon Valley Bank.
I think if they thought there was risk of contagion to the market, yes, it would have happened. But listen, Patrick McHenry, who's very good on these issues, the chair of the Financial Services Committee, said this is the first Twitter-fueled bank run. People were just chatting about it on Twitter, pulled their money out, and went to larger banks. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And a friend of mine said this morning, if Twitter were around or as prominent as it is now in 08, 09, we would have been in a whole different situation.
Yeah, the difference between 08 and 09 is that money market funds had frozen overnight. John Campbell, the very conservative former member of House Finance, he's retired now, told me easiest vote, most difficult vote he ever made was in favor of TARP, but he saw the overnight funds freezing up and realized the whole system was coming down. I just think they grabbed onto that argument, Jake, and made it everywhere, all around the clock. And while SPV might have not had any lobbyists, their clients did. I mean, it was a full court press. And if they're worried about me, who knows what Patrick McHenry heard over the weekend?
Yeah, I don't have any reporting to indicate the lobbying effort. I would have to imagine that there were people advocating on behalf of getting there were a lot of people advocating on behalf of raising the insured deposit limit. But now, basically, the insured deposit limit for all these banks is infinity.
You know, that's it.
Dollars,
that's
you know?
It.
So, and by the way, the $250,000 limit is relatively new. Before Dodd-Frank in 2008, it was $100,000. Excuse me. So there's a lot of angles to look at here. Hugh, here's what we'll be watching. We'll be watching the Congress dig into this, because you have no doubt the Congress is going to look at why they weren't hedging their interest rate exposure, why they sold $2 billion bonds at a $2 billion loss. And then the larger question, the macro question, is are there any changes to the bank regulatory environment that we'll see?
Oh, there's also a big issue about what are they funding? They are funding green initiatives. They are the ESG bank of choice, the DEI bank of choice.
But that has nothing to do with why they failed you. That has nothing to do with it.
No, it does. It's the fact that they failed is because they didn't act like normal bankers. They acted like venture capitalist partners, which is not what banks are supposed to do. And the fact that their chief financial officer went vacant for 6 months, the fact that they had to raise capital at $2.5 billion last week, the other regional banks weren't out there asking for $2.5 billion in new raises. What really happened here, Jake? It might have been necessary, but there isn't yet honesty from Yellen and everybody else. You know, minutes before the bailout was announced, our friends at Axios said Joe Biden telling his friends in Silicon Valley no bailout. Well, Joe Biden not really running this game. The Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen ran this game, and they decided, well, we're not going to let this one go under. I just believe any other regional bank would have, depositors there would have caught in the short stick, but they now all get the guarantee. I mean, they can't let another bank fail now, can they, Jake?
No, and the most at risk was, as I said, First Republic Bank, which is a large institution that, again, has a very narrow cast customer base in New York and in California and other wealthy places. And they got, I think, $50 billion in financing from J.P. Morgan over the weekend, which was undoubtedly arranged or at least encouraged, let's say, by the Biden administration, which was trying to do its best to firm up some of these small regional banks, which, you know, were at risk. Let's just be honest. They were at risk.
Oh, George W. Bush, on the last Wednesday of his presidency, brought in 6 talk show hosts. I was among them to explain, go easy on the new guy, because you have no idea what it's like every Sunday afternoon in 2008 to be meeting with Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson about the latest existential threat to the financial system. I don't think Joe Biden had a meeting about this. I think he got told what to do and he did it because he doesn't understand this. I mean, this is very hard stuff to understand. But Jake, let's go back to the ski chalet. This is a bank that owned a ski chalet and sent their well-heeled investors there and depositors. They are everything that's wrong with America in terms of elites versus non-elites. You expect to hear a lot about this on the campaign trail.
About the ski chalet, this is the first I've heard of it, but I expect to hear a lot about everything on the campaign trail, to be honest with you.
I think Silicon Valley Bank and the Stanford DEI meltdown, these issues are not going anywhere. Jake Sherman will be all over them, as Punchbowl News AM is already this morning. Go and read it. Come right back here to the Monday edition. And welcome to our new friends on News Talk Memphis, 990 AM, 107.9 FM. Great to have you listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's going to be a rough day for some small banks on the markets today. First Republic Bank, and we also have other banks under pressure that don't have great balance sheet. Not sure they're going to get the same blue bubble bailout that our friends at the Silicon Valley Bank, home of wokeness, DEI, and ESG, got over the weekend. Josh Kroshauer joins me. Good morning, Josh. I have never seen so much lobbying in a concentrated period of time. as I did over the last 48 hours. And it worked for the connected blue bubble people in the Silicon Valley. How's it going to play politically?
Well, look, bailouts, especially when you're talking about a pretty wealthy group of individuals, are not going to play well politically for any either Republicans or Democrats. Though I'm seeing more criticism on the Republican side. Nikki Haley put out a statement over the weekend criticizing or urging against any bailouts at the time. Vivek Ramaswamy, who wrote the book Woke Inc., wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal decrying this bailout as well. But look, I think in the end, you know, there was a fear that there could be a contagion in smaller banks, especially, that could have really devastated the markets in a greater sense if they didn't do anything over the weekend. And I think that the bigger picture politically prevailed. And by the way, Hugh, there's an interesting division within, and I know Ron DeSantis and some other Republicans have criticized, you just mentioned this as well, that, you know, there was a lot of woke tendencies at the Silicon Valley Bank. But, you know, all politics is local, and I'm seeing a lot of these anti-woke commentators who have money or have some investments tied up or connected to the Silicon Valley Bank urging for a bailout, and some prominent figures among them calling for the bailout. So,
Josh, my people, the small to medium-sized businesses, I heard from some of them over the weekend, support a bailout because if you do $2 million of cash a month in revenue, you can't be at one bank. You've got to be, you can't manage $250,000 account. It just doesn't work if your payroll's bigger than that. You've got to be spread out over a number of banks. So they were asking for a blanket raise of the FDIC limit so that small businesses didn't get screwed by collapsing banks. That's not what they did. They just, they refused to acknowledge the reality because they know the politics of it are obviously bad. I wish they would just be honest with people.
Well, there was a lot of, there were a lot of nuances in the discussion, but I did note that Vivek Ramaswamy, one of the anti-woke presidential candidates who announced this month, clashing with another anti-woke commentator. And I think that commentator supported what the Biden administration ended up doing and indeed put out a statement online saying that he was for what happened. So it is interesting. I mean, I always have heard the phrase, sort of a worn cliche in politics, all politics is local. It's not always the case anymore, but people who had investments, people who had something to lose with the Silicon the potential of the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, all of a sudden felt a lot differently than they did about bailouts to other corporations or individuals.
I've got David McCormick coming up at the bottom of the next hour, the once and future Senate candidate and former CEO of a VC firm, and he's going to come on. One of the things he quoted is a saying I'd not heard before: "Where you sit decides where you stand." I've heard where you sit depends upon where you see, but your political positions are going to be derived from the office in which you sit. And a bunch of investors in startups and a bunch of those startups and a bunch of blue bros and venture capitalists were all over the phones yesterday and the day before hammering everything. And Ro Khanna did a fine job defending his constituents. I just don't think the administration is being honest. It was a bailout. That's all it was. It's a bailout.
Yeah, and back to the politics, Hugh. If you're, and sometimes we learned in 2008 with the Bush administration, the TARP program. I mean, that may have saved the economy. So it's not like bailouts are inherently bad, but politically they're always going to be tough. That vote for TARP was a huge problem, and split the Republican Party back then in two. And things have gotten even more, moved more in the other direction since then. So the notion, it's an easy bumper sticker saying to say that you bailed out the big wealthy Silicon Valley tech bros and you didn't help people who are struggling to make ends meet in Ohio. That is a bumper sticker. It's something that's politically sellable, and it's something that I'm sure that a lot of Republicans are going to attack the Biden administration.
Billions for the blue bubble, not even the time of day for Eastern Ohio and Western PA. I got to ask you about the Stanford DEI meltdown, Josh. I'm obsessed because I'm a law professor, and I can't imagine this happening to a federal judge. I was talking with other federal judges about it on Friday night, and quite a lot of, just dismay. And I think it feeds into the DEI narrative in politics today as well. What do you think?
Yeah, it's not just a narrative, it's reality. And I've heard the line or the phrase cry bullies to talk about some of these people who shut down speech and attack people or try to shut down people who they don't agree with and bully them. And that's what you saw in this video. You should, anyone should watch the 9-minute video of this Stanford DEI administrator, literally basically calling for the federal judge's speech. I mean, she was trying to kind of find some middle ground, but her middle ground was so far to the extreme that she basically said that his views were hurting the feelings of other people, and he should, you know, take one for the team and just leave.
The squeeze was not worth the juice. It was crazy. I played the whole thing in the first hour. Just crazy and emblematic of what blue bubble thinking gets you. Josh Krossauer, the opposite of blue bubble thinking. He is actually purple. I have no idea what he thinks or votes politically. He's a good reporter. Josh Krossauer on Twitter. Follow him there. Thank you, Josh. Billions for Silicon Valley, nothing for the Central American poor who don't have enough to eat. Our friends at Food for the Poor are spending all of this month on the Hugh Hewitt Show sponsoring a campaign to feed the people who don't want to leave their villages, but there is no food. They had North without it. Here's Paul Jacobs of Food for the Poor, shocked to find that there was zero food at one of the feeding centers in Guatemala. Food for the Poor is remedying that, but it was Paul Jacobs' reaction that I thought priceless. Cut number two, Paul Jacobs.
These families desperately need the food that is served here when it's made available. They do not have the money, and they cannot afford the rising food costs. There is not one tortilla on the stove, one pot of chicken stew, not even an orange to give to the children. So we're inviting you to be a part of the transformation. It's you.
It is you. All you have to do is go to HughHewitt.com. Way to beat. And the Give Life, Give Food banner appears at the top. You can't miss it. Or call 855-359-HOPE. That's 855-359-4673. Especially if you're a depositor at Silicon Valley Bank. And I know you're driving in this morning. You're listening to me in San Francisco and in the Valley. You just got saved billions by the taxpayers. How about some pennies for the poor? HughHewitt.com, Food for the Poor banner. I'll be right back. Welcome back, America. Time for the Yinzer Report. Selena Zito comes to us from somewhere in Pennsylvania. She's on the road this morning on a cell phone. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning. How are you? Heading to Wisconsin this morning.
What is up in Wisconsin? Somebody declaring for president up there?
No, that's state Supreme Court race.
Oh, that's good. No one's paying any attention to that, so you can tell us about that next week. I want to talk to you about David McCormick, about the bailout of the Silicon Valley Bank, and about East Palestine and Western Pennsylvania. In a nutshell, billions for blue bubble venture capitalists in the Silicon Valley. The Biden administration won't give the time of day to East Palestine and Western Pennsylvania. Think people are going to remember that?
Yeah, they're definitely going to remember that. It is this never ending snub and insult to the middle of America. Anything that's about 15 to 20 minutes outside of a major city doesn't get the attention, or doesn't have the importance, or there's not an urgency to whatever happens in those areas.
Yeah, wouldn't the people of East Palestine have appreciated a response, at least even 50% of the response that the Silicon Valley Bank got over the weekend?
No, they haven't gotten at all the kind of response that they need. I mean, their lives are upended forever. Their lives will never be the same. And I've been spending weeks there in East Palestine, but also in Darlington, Pennsylvania. As many of you may not know, that East Palestine is right on the border of Ohio, right across from Darlington, Pennsylvania. I mean, in all of these areas, their whole lives have been upended.
Yeah, East Palestine people are like the Starks in Game of Thrones. They hold the wall against the people on the other side, the Pittsburghers coming over. I saw you interview Dave McCormick. He's coming on today to talk about his book, Superpower in Peril. Is he aware of this? Did you talk about the casual disregard for Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio demonstrated by Team Biden and Leader Buttigieg?
Oh, he's definitely aware of what's going on. He's been, you know, he and I talked a lot about, the interview went for a while, And we talked about leadership. We talked about the importance of showing up. And there's similarities in terms of leadership showing up between Afghanistan, what happened in Afghanistan on August 27th and 2021, and not showing up for the people of East Palestine from Biden, and sort of the dismissiveness of it and the lack of empathy. That's one thing that McCormick possesses a lot of, and that's empathy. He's a guy, for all of his great accomplishments in the corporate world, he's a guy that is much more comfortable being at a bowling alley or, you know, at the gun range than he is at, you know, this sort of high-end event.
Now, if you've run a platoon, Company C in the 82nd Airborne during Desert Storm, you're going to be comfortable with everybody. He talks about that in his book. Let me conclude, Selena, by asking you just generally, this Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I know about it. I think the election's in April. Who is the originalist and who is the left-wing nut?
Well, I don't have that memorized. here's what alarmed me this week. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the Hollywood actress that was best known for Seinfeld, she started tweeting about it. And it just made me think, you know, the Democrats are all ready for this. They understand that this is an important race that could decide and change everything, including the majority in the House. And they're investing money and they're rallying their people. And the Republicans aren't ready yet.
Absolutely not. And they got to realize that if the progressive lefty wins, and as opposed to the originalist judge, they'll throw their congressional districts out that were drawn by the legislature.
Gone. Like what happened in Pennsylvania. This is Pennsylvania all over again.
Yeah.
And I don't think Republicans, in particular, Republicans with money, understand. But the Democrats have money coming out of their ears. Republicans have nothing.
Well, all those blue bubble people in Silicon Valley are going to contribute now because they've got to do something. They're not going to give to Food for the Poor. So they're going to go give to a Wisconsin Supreme Court race that nobody knows about because they've got to express their gratitude to Team Biden some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you will, if the Democrats are successful in Wisconsin and the Republicans are just sitting on their hands and don't pay attention to this, this is the most important race this year. And if they're not paying attention to it.
You're absolutely right, Selena Zito. I want a report next week, please. I'll look for your columns, write a lot of them, alert everyone that the Republicans have got to get out and vote in April. And we'll talk more about that next week from the Yinzer Report. Follow her on Twitter at Zito Selena, at Zito Selena. You follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Amidst all the drama of the weekend, the Oscars last night, the bailout of the Silicon Valley Bank, the Stanford Law School meltdown, a lot of people missed by far the most important story, the one that's going to affect you and your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, in that the Chinese Communist Party brought together Saudi Arabia and Iran, longtime enemies, together in Beijing to shake hands and get the party started again, and the United States didn't even know about it. Here to talk about that is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Len Khodorkovsky. Message from Len on Twitter. Good morning, Len. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. It's always great to start the week with Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. I don't think people paid attention because so much was happening, right? They're afraid their banks are collapsing. They're watching with horror the DEI dean at Stanford berating a federal judge. They watched the Oscars. Free agency tampering begins today. And in the middle of all this comes a geopolitical development that not many people focused on. Explain what happened and why it's significant, Len, and how Team Biden has screwed up yet again.
Well, there are a number of dynamics that are in play here. First, I think, and foremost, from the Saudi perspective, is they don't trust the Biden administration. As you recall, President Biden, before he became president, he called the Saudis a pariah state. This was as Joe Biden as a candidate. So he essentially pivoted back to the Obama era policy of isolating our friends and trying to hinge our Middle East policy on Iran. As crazy as this sounds, this goes back to the Obama administration's desire to broker the JCPOA deal, which the Trump administration left, which actually rebuilt trust with the Saudis and other allies in the region, Arabs, Israelis. We actually took back American interests in the region. And then the Biden administration came along, of course, called them pariah state, tried to recalibrate back to the Iran deal. This is the same group of people that worked for Obama who now work for Biden, and they screwed this up royally. The other issue is, and I think this goes beyond the Biden administration, is our friends in the region believe the United States is leaving the region. That is the predominant assumption among our friends and among our enemies. So having that assumption, all of those players believe that they need to hedge their bets. They can't rely on America to stick around for the long term, so they better play the Chinese and the Iranians just in case. Now, that doesn't mean that the Saudis, the Chinese, and the Iranians are best friends all of a sudden, but it is almost like a realpolitik formula here to ensure that their interests are protected. Of course, from the Chinese perspective, anytime they get to rub it in and step into the vacuum created by the United States is a net positive. They also try to ensure a free flow of oil because they guzzle up oil more than any other country in the world. For Iranians, of course, it gives them credibility in the midst of destabilizing protests. They may also get access to some money as a result of that and negotiating for the exchange of detainees. Of course, they're holding our citizen hostage. We're holding their criminals in prison.
You know, Lynn, I'm old enough to remember where 30 years of American diplomacy went into getting the Russian communists out of the Middle East, which was almost effectively completed by the time W left office and Barack Obama came in. They immediately got the Russians back into Syria. They also opened the door for the Iranians to recapitalize with the JCPOA. And now we find one of the two big enchiladas, as Richard Nixon called them, Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran got lost to the revolution in 1979 under Carter. And now I'm afraid Joe Biden team just lost Saudi Arabia to Beijing. And that's the key thing here. There's one superpower at a time. There's always the most powerful power. I think we're still it, but Beijing is making a bid to become that. And I don't think we got caught with our pants down. I just do not think we had any idea this was going on.
Well, I think we knew that they were talking for a couple of years. Remember, a couple of years ago, Iran and China had a bilateral deal that ensured their relationship for 25 years. We do know that, look, I mean, the Saudis, and as much as the Ilhan Omars of Congress, when I hate on Saudis, they're an important ally in the region. And I think the sooner we realize that alienating our friends is not in America's national interest, then we would still be looked at the alpha dog in the world. If we stop doing that and we assume that people are just going to look to America for leadership just because we want them to, that's not going to happen. So, the Chinese are playing this game. Look, I think in the long run, I don't believe that this deal is going to pan out. Neither the Iranians or the Chinese can be trusted. And I think the Saudis are sober enough to understand that. I think it's a Band-Aid in the short run. I think to some extent it's a snub to the Biden administration.
Of course.
To say that, okay, well, you don't want to play with us. That's fine. We'll go play with the Chinese. And of course, it feeds into that belief that we're leaving the region. Therefore, leaving the region so that we can focus more on China. So the Saudis are saying, you want to focus more on China? We'll bring China over here so you can focus more in the Middle East. So in a way, it's a little bit of a poker play here.
It's a flip in the Nixon script, and the Middle Kingdom has become central to Middle East politics, and we did not want that. I also want to go to the other side of the playbook. The Biden administration's principal issue in the Middle East is the Israeli judicial reform. Believe it or not, everyone out there, the number one issue driving Biden administration policy vis-a-vis Israel is keeping their left-wing Supreme Court intact. This is from the same people who want to destroy our Supreme Court by packing it. It makes no sense for us to be meddling in Israel's domestic policy. It did make sense for us to expand the Abraham Accords, but I don't think that's going to happen now. I think Team Biden has so screwed up Saudi Arabia and their allied Sunni states that they're just not trusting us, Len. How long is it going to take to fix this damage?
It will take some effort. It will take another Republican administration on January 20th, 2025 to step in and start patching things up again. We did it in the Trump administration. The regional players began trusting us again, which of course yielded the Abraham Accords. Don't forget, four peace deals in about 4 months, five if you count Kosovo, actually. It's possible, but it's a step backward that we're going to need to address when we come back in. So it certainly makes things more difficult. There's no doubt about it. And it is not in our national interest.
Now, I want to focus in exclusively on Iran for a moment. The new axis of evil, the new axis, is Iran and Russia as vassal states to the Chinese Communist Party. That's how I believe it. David McCormick will be on the show a little bit later, Superpower in Peril, who calls out, by the way, your colleague Keith Kroc for having a great clean network program. And David worked very closely with them on developing that. He's coming on later to talk about the Chinese Communist Party, but he sort of backhands the Iran issue because it's not front and center. They remain a giant threat to the world. And I don't know that people even paid attention to the uranium breakout. They are now within, what, 10 days of having a nuclear weapon? Is that what your understanding is, Len, when they want to go for it?
Well, first of all, I recommend David's book highly. I think he's a serious thinker. He definitely has been an ally in, as you say, the clean network effort to counter China's march to dominance in 5G and high tech. That is still the predominant battle that we need to win. In terms of the breakout, yes, they do have enough material for a nuclear weapon. It takes a long time. It's not enough just to have the material. You need a warhead. You need a delivery system. I don't think they're quite there yet, so I don't think we're on the edge of apocalypse here. But it is problematic, and I do want to address this fact. You've heard the Biden administration officials recently say that after we left the Iran deal, the Iranians all of a sudden sprinted toward this threshold nuclear state. That is, in fact, inaccurate. On November 8th, the election day on 2020, the Iranians were enriching at 4.5%. After the election day, they broke out to where we are right now, near 80%. So the entire sprint can be traced back to the Iranian regime believing that the Biden administration is going to be a lot softer. Of course, President Biden ran on getting back into JCPOA. That was part of his platform. And that is what led to the to where we are today. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to get it. And, you know, the Israelis said they can't live with a nuclear Iran. I hope the United States will have their back, and I hope our European friends will, too. Part of this whole JCPOA charade is the whole idea that you can negotiate security of countries in the region like Israel, the Saudis, Bahrainis, Emiratis, without them at the table. And that has sown a lot of distrust. And that's a template that hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. But at the same time, look, I think we're in a more dangerous place when it comes to Iran right now. We're also in more I want to have a more hopeful outlook here. I believe the women-led revolution in Iran right now is actually a sign of what's to come. I don't think the regime is going to survive for much longer if the United States and our allies don't save it. We need to, and this is where the Saudi deal comes in. which can potentially save Iran by enriching it again, by giving it more money to spend on terrorism in the region, to kill Americans, to kill our allies, to shoot rockets at Saudi Arabia, to arm Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas. So, like, that is the only way the regime can survive. So I think it behooves us to put our differences aside in terms of, you know, if Trump did it, then it must be wrong. It's really important for our national security interest for us to be sober about the region, to take the opportunities where we can get them, and the opportunities to turn Iran toward a more democratic country.
From your lips, Len, from your
United States, because its people love democracy, they love freedom, would be in our own best interest.
From your lips to the State Department and the Biden administration's ears, but I don't think they're listening. Second Democratic administration in a row to make nice with Iran, to our great detriment and to Beijing's great benefit. Len Kornikoski, follow him on Twitter at Message from Len. Follow me in the next segment. Thank you, Len. I'll be right back, America.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.